Welcome to a new episode of the DSAI podcast, where we delve into the exciting realms of technology, innovation, and cutting-edge ideas. Today, we're joined by an exceptional guest, Simon Alicia, a chief technologist at Amazon Web Services and a major influencer in the world of cloud computing across Australia, New Zealand, and Oceania. Simon's passion for staying at the forefront of technology and his 20-plus years of experience have made him a force to be reckoned with in the tech industry. In this episode, we'll explore Simon's fascinating career journey, discussing his passion for deep diving into tech, staying close to its rapid evolution, and championing digital literacy in leadership. From discussing the role of architecture in technology and the transformative power of event-driven architectures and serverless computing, Simon's insights will provide an enlightening perspective on the technology of today and tomorrow. We'll also navigate Simon's views on how we must adapt to the increasing focus on sustainability and the ecological cost of processing. He touches on how the technology sector can and should aim for carbon neutrality and the emerging influence of regulation in this area. Finally, we will explore Simon's thought-provoking views on the necessity for technologists to stay connected with the technology they advocate for, his emphasis on the hands-on experience and staying relevant in the rapidly changing technology landscape is truly inspiring. Buckle up for a thought-provoking and informative ride with Simon Alicia. We hope you enjoy this episode as much as we enjoyed recording it. Let's jump right into it. Hi, Simon, and welcome to the Data Science and AI Association of Australia podcast. How's it going, man?
Good, thanks, Paul. Thanks so much for having me. It's nice to be on the other side of the desk here.
it's very super excited to be talking to you and to finally set up a time with you. I know you've been super busy this last month, the summit and whatnot. So everyone listening in, Simon Alicia is the chief technologist of AWS Australia. Did I get that right?
That's correct. Guilty as charged.
And we're just discussing before, you've been working at Amazon since 2011?
Since 2011, yeah. I was actually the first solution architect in the region. So I got to see some stuff as cloud started to become something beyond what is cloud into how do I use cloud and then how do I make the best of cloud. So it's been a tremendously humbling journey.
You would have a lot of great insights that, well, let's try and get some of them, extract some of those out of you today.
Pull them out.
Yeah, that's it. So where I usually like to start the podcast is just kind of a history on how you got into essentially technology, where maybe like take us through your background, what you studied, what drew you to technology and what sort of to get to that 2011 point.
Sure. I think I've often mused that I don't know what I would do if computers hadn't been invented. And the reason why I mention that is, you know, when I was 13, I got an Apple II Plus clone. It was called a Wombat. It was an Australian ripoff of the Apple computer. Mm. And the ability to program was just something that really intrigued me. And I just loved the ability to make stuff. And in those days, I sound like Grandpa Simpson, but in those days, you know, there was no internet. There was no sharing of information. Like what you had is what you built or, you know, swapping floppy disks with your mates and that sort of stuff, which was good. And that really lit the fire for me. And then I got into, you know, bulletin board systems and 300 board modems, and I got a printer, which was revolutionary. But that, I think that joy of creation using technology really just sparked in me as a kid. And when I finished, you know, VCEs, it was in those days, it was like, well, I'm doing computers. That's what I'm doing. And I actually started off though in mainframes. Back in the early 90s, which is still a technology that we use today and taught me a lot of really important fundamental lessons, but it's a very different way of computing. And then moved through client server. That was the next big wave. Then the first iteration of the web and what that looked like. And that was some crazy times in the late 90s. And then with the dot-com explosion, that was something else in itself. And then moving more into sort of open systems, sort of your sort of Sun, Solaris and Oracle systems, and building really large scale systems became the thing I really like to do. And then I moved into infrastructure for a while, first in infrastructure software as a storage software specialist.
Sorry to interrupt, but like circa what year is this?
This would be, I'd say early 2000s would be when I got into the software.
I don't mean any offense here, but you look really young. So,
I shave my hair, so that stops the white hairs coming. I'm 51, so I've been doing this for a while.
You're doing very well. Yeah.
So sort of through that journey, moved into the software space. Then I spent a bit of time in consulting. I worked at PricewaterhouseCoopers for a while as a consultant, which was really interesting because it taught me a lot about what business thinks about technology. And at sort of at that point so far in my career, I was very much all about the technology and you know, we're always right, we're the developers, we know it's better, what are those idiots doing? You know, that sort of mental model that you have when you're young and foolish. And being on the other side of the table actually helped me understand, well, people have to pay for this and you need to justify it and it has to make sense. And so that was really interesting. Then moved into storage, the world of storage, and worked at a company called Veritas for a while, and we did high availability and clustering and backup and all that sort of good things. And then I moved into hardware, which is sort of a different way of thinking about the world and really getting close to storage hardware and how the bits hit the metal. Or the rust in this case, not the development rust, the actual rust on the hard disk. Yeah. And after a while doing that, I moved to Cisco and I was an enterprise architect there and worked a lot with sort of the more converged infrastructure type world. And then one fateful day, I get this phone call from some random recruiter. Recruiters get a bad rap and I won't hear about it because recruiters have been good to me. But I get this random call out of the blue from this guy. He says, you know, you've never heard from me before. You don't know who I am. I think I've got a job that you'd be fantastic for and you'd really enjoy. And I'm like, dude, I work at Cisco. Like, there's not many companies I'd work for anyway. I'm in a great company, in a great place for using great technology. It would have to be a pretty amazing place for me to want to come and work there. And he said, it's Amazon. And I said, I'm listening. So in 2011, Amazon out here wasn't a thing. I knew of it and I'd been using AWS for my own personal projects for a little while, but the concept of being part of something like that was pretty amazing. So that's sort of the lightning fast trip to 2011 when that happened. Mm-hmm. And I got to start on a pretty amazing journey in the cloud.
So you got extensive back-end experience. Pretty much from the start of the internet. It sounds like you have hardware experience.
Network server, storage. I can rack and stack with the best of them.
PwC, Cisco, you got the call from the recruiter. You were hooked. You were listening. You went in. How did you get, this has been like the really early days of AWS. Cause I remember like hearing about cloud 2009, 2010, just like it was this esoteric concept, kind of like, I don't know if like Bitcoin went in 2017, sort of thing. So what was your role back then?
Yeah, it was super early. So I was interviewing for what was called a principal solution architect. Mm. And that was the role where you go and talk about how to solve people's problems using the technology at hand. Mm. And I was actually the eighth in the world that existed in Amazon. So you rightly say, Amazon was a lot smaller then. Now we're about 1.5 million people overall. Back then it was 16,000 people in the company. So it's totally different experience. And it was like being in a startup that was very well funded. Mm. And so it was one of those, you know, in your career, I reckon you get maybe one of those types of opportunities if you're lucky. And thankfully for me, that was the one that it was the right place, the right time, the right skill set. And it was fantastic. It was scary as well. Like I remember the first few months, I'd wake up almost in a cold sweat at 5 o'clock in the morning going, oh my God, there's so much I've got to learn and do. And I can't get across it all. And it's too much sort of thing. But, you just plow through it and you get there. And it's wonderful after you sort of move through that, conscious incompetence phase.
Yeah.
Sure. But everything was new. And it was really the point of like literally the conversation was, what is the cloud? Like that was the conversation we're having now. Probably for a lot of your listeners, they can't even understand that because they potentially, did their schooling on the cloud and grew up and all that sort of stuff. Yet those days it was, what is the cloud? And closely followed by, well, we'd never use it. We can't see a reason to use it. And it's been fascinating to be part of that change process. You know, the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. I've lived that. Because I knew the reason I joined Amazon was I thought, I knew I'd been using the services anyway. And I thought, this is the way to get things done better, faster, and cheaper. Like, we have an opportunity here to really do better from a technology standpoint. This is definitely the future. And so I really wanted to be a part of it. And so I kind of nailed my colors to the mast and said, this is how we should build software. This is how we should deliver IT. And luckily I was right, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it says a lot about you. Like when you take that career, when you take a risk opportunity in your career, like you said, you nailed yourself to the mast in the direction cloud in this case, and then it turns to and it pays out for you. Like, I don't know, that says something a lot about you. I just think if you're willing to take risk like that and it pays off, it's just, I don't know, even more satisfying, if that makes sense.
Well, look, I equally could have been wrong, but I guess I've always been a technology pragmatist is what I like to call myself, which is, you know, I think it's about using the right thing for the job and doing the right thing by others. And, you know, in my career, a big part of my career has been on, I guess, what you call the vendor side. So, you know, selling or representing things for customers. And one thing I recognized very early on is, you know, it's a very small industry. There are people I've interacted with on a commercial basis multiple times in completely different roles over 20 years. Like, just you can't afford to misrepresent something, misrepresent yourself. You know, the concept of integrity is vital. And so, you know, when I go and talk to folks about how to use the cloud and how not to use the cloud and where to use the services and why, et cetera, it comes from a place of a practitioner and also saying, hey, this is, you know, these are the things I can explain why this makes sense or why it doesn't make sense as well. You know, it's important to have both sides of the coin and both sides of the conversation. But I think in anything you do in technology, if you don't believe in the technology, not from a woo-woo believe, but from a, I've really dug deep into this, I can see the value, I can see the amazingness, there's something here I have to share with others. Once you discover that, then it's fantastic, and it exists everywhere in different guises.
Yeah, I guess to try reiterate what I said earlier was I did kind of something similar with my career. I nailed myself to the mast, as it were, with AI, and that sort of paid off as well. Well, it could equally not have as well.
I've seen many an AI winter, my friend. It's it could have gone completely the other way. You got to decide, don't you? You got to satisfy yourself.
100%. And that's, job satisfaction. So, all right. So you're one of the first solutions architects at Amazon. So you would have seen the technology evolve tremendously from 2011 through to 2023, where you are now chief technologist of AWS Australia. Would you mind walking us through that?
Yeah. I think what's really interesting is the way that we think about building services for customers at Amazon. That's one of the things that appealed to me, which is, you know, we want to be customer centric. And so we listen to our customers and build what they will ask us for. In fact, over 90% of the roadmap comes from customer input and customer suggestions. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at how AWS evolved over time, and I think when I joined, there were maybe 8 to 10 services. Now there's well over 200. And basically, it was simply a function of firstly building really robust primitives. So you need a storage service, you need network, you need compute, you need messaging systems, you need, you know, that glue to bring things together, you need scheduling, all these types of things, and they have to work at massive scale without any interruption. So one of the even most basic differences of operating the cloud versus previous generation IT is there was no outage window. Like, you know, when I was building systems and delivering large-scale infrastructure, we still had, you know, you could have Sunday or you could have a couple of hours here or a couple of hours there. You could negotiate. There was no negotiations. Like, you've got customers around the world in all time zones using APIs 24/7. There is no downtime. Completely different way of thinking about it. But really what's changed over the years is customers asking for more and more sophisticated things. So at the start, it's like, hey, just give me server storage and networking and this solves a whole bunch of problems I've got, which it did. But then it moves to, well, I need a data warehouse, or now I need to be able to stand up a call center on demand, or this computer vision thing looks really interesting for my manufacturing environment. How can I deploy that? Or give me some sort of edge compute that I can run on a ship or on the space station or wherever. You know, all these things come about. And really, when I talk to folks about AWS in particular and the cloud in general, it's It's like this amazing kit bag of all the toys that you could want to build something. Mm-hmm. And you're not doing yourself justice if you don't look at your cloud provider's, you know, menu of things and go, wow, they've, you know, someone else has had this problem. They've asked for the solution. The solution is here. I can go grab it and do it. And really what the change is we've moved into very much an assembly world. Mm-hmm. You know, you bring together different APIs, different services, some in the cloud, some you write yourself, et cetera. And that all comes together. And I constantly find myself battling my own habit, which is because of my background of where I started from. In my day, you built everything. Like, oh, I need a compiler. I'll build one. You know, you need to write a program to track whatever. I'll start it from absolute scratch. Like, you know, line 10, start. You know, and that's not the world we live in now. Now it's like you want to play this game of assembling the minimum number of components to get the outcome you want. And I think it was Michelangelo, one of the famous sculptors, who said, you know, how do you sculpt sculptures? He says, well, I just knock away the things that shouldn't be there, which is really obvious when you're him. But that's kind of system design is, you know, what's the least amount of effort I can do to make something hook together? And that's, I think, what's really exciting, because there's no barrier anymore. And when I talk to graduates, et cetera, and particularly more sort of, I'd say 5 years ago, a lot of folks coming out of university, oh, what are employees looking for, et cetera? I say, well, what have you built? Show me something you built. Show me something that's on GitHub that you built or a project you contributed to. And some of them got it, and some of them would look at me blankly going, well, what do you mean? I'm like, well, there's nothing stopping you. You've got more compute power from your laptop out into the world on all these free tiers of these cloud providers than, you know, people had to send the Apollo mission to the moon. There's nothing to stop you. And that, I think, is the revolution from cloud computing's perspective, is you could move so quickly, you could do it at very low cost, and if you didn't want to continue, you could just stop and stop paying for it. And the big shift that happened was, it used to be that to get access to the best technology, you had to work for a big company who had deep pockets to buy the big iron. And that changed around 2015, I'd say, is that sort of cutover point where that took place, where now it's often the reverse. Often you don't have the good stuff in your big stuffy company. You've almost got to bust out of it to get the nice stuff going.
Mm. Yeah, I actually remember that when it changed over. Like I was actually experimenting with AWS around 2015. And like logging into the CLI and being able to do stuff I was never capable of doing on my own computer.
So exciting.
Did you have much to do with the AI and machine learning sort of shift around 2017? How did you see unfolding?
Yeah, so it was really interesting that whole shift, because I think that was like the, you know, if we think about the froth and excitement today, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, but the transition then was really just the sort of this awareness of there's something here, there's something we should pay attention to. And so I found myself talking to a lot of folks about, the art of the possible. And through those conversations and through the work we do internally at AWS as well, is it became very clear that the place where machine learning, particularly at that time, really landed strongly is on those very boring, repetitive tasks that machines are really good at doing and humans are really bad at doing. So imagine managing, for example, a global network like AWS has. It would be really boring to have teams and teams of people trying to manage them the old way in terms of understanding network flow and packet loss and adjusting for internet health and other stuff. That's where machine learning comes into place. And so we were building lots and lots of different models in pretty much all of our services to help with some of that stuff and to optimize things. And through that process, what we also recognized was that the barrier to entry for machine learning was too high for a lot of customers. And so we tackled it with kind of two approaches, three approaches to be fair. So one, the one approach was, hey, here's the bare metal, all the PyTorch, the MXNet, all the models you want, TensorFlow, the bare metal stuff, go for it. You can build as close to the middle as you want. Great. Which is good for a percentage of people. But then there was this other percentage of people who were like, hey, just give me an API call. Yes, I love the concept of, you know, voice to text or comprehending information and understanding sentiment or converting, you know, documents into machine readable text, all that, the classic use cases, you know, forecasting. Just give me a bunch of APIs. I want to call them. I don't want to train the model. I don't want to do any of that. You guys do that. And so we released a whole lot of services around, you know, computer vision and voice and text and all that sort of language processing type stuff that really matched well. And then in between, we released a service called Amazon SageMaker, which helps people build their own models. And really what that was about was smoothing out that whole development lifecycle. Because what we found very quickly as we were talking to folks in the industry who are trying to build these models and work with other teams was that all the scaffolding that existed for a software developer didn't exist for a machine learning model developer. So, you know, step one, wrangle the data. Well, that's hard in itself. Step two, build the model. Step three, test the model. Step four, you know, validate and prove that the model is fair. Step five, deploy the model into production. Step six, continue retraining. You know, all these types of things that had to be done. We really had to work on building all that out to reduce the amount of time that folks had to spend on that. And I think once that started to be available to people, it became more accessible and people started to inject machine learning, not in its sort of in-your-face way, but in the way that software could run and could be built and could operate. And that started really changing the way that it was absorbed into different organizations. So I think at first people were thinking, well, there's going to be this machine learning thing and it's going to make all these amazing business decisions for and on our behalf. And really it was all about making these really small decisions at large scale. You know, a simple example being, you know, I've got a camera in a factory pointing at a component making machine. And this machine makes millions of components and the camera is looking at the components coming off the line. The quality control is that the model knows what a good component and a bad component looks like. It should be able to flag immediately when there's a bad component there. Now, again, the old days, you'd have a person trying to sample a few different things or look at things. And say, we don't do that anymore. It's all machine learning. That's the use case I think really resonated at that point in time that led to kind of the new dawn of using machine learning in a meaningful way.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear your take on it. I got to live through that era too, and one of the things you highlighted that was really important there was just how the pipelines didn't really exist. Those six or seven steps you mentioned, which all had to be done manually, and now you could just piece it together and boom.
It was hard. It was really, really hard to do, and it was expensive, and it was risky. And again, back to if I bring back that business perspective I was mentioning before, you know, none of those things from a business stakeholder standpoint are good. I don't want to hear risk. I don't want to hear unpredictable. No. I don't want to hear lots of manual steps. I don't want to hear they have to hire really hard to find people.
Yes, exactly. I mean,
goodness me, exactly. At that stage it was impossible. Let alone now get, you know, and then they sit down, then my data scientist tells me, well, this is great. Now you need to provide me half a petabyte of data to train my model and 1,000 people to manually tag it so that it can learn. No one's going to say yes to that, or very few people are going to say yes to that readily, even if they think the idea is good.
Yeah. It just made it way easier. Again, like you don't need your specialists. Well, you still do, but
doing the really special part. They're the ones who need to focus on what is the business use case. That was the big thing. Was if I had a meeting with someone that said, tell me about machine learning or tell me about AI, I'd immediately say to them, well, you tell me what business problem you're trying to solve. That's the starting point. Because if you just say, I want AI or I want to machine learn, you're starting from the wrong end of the stick. And so 100%. It really became a case of let's define the problem. Then let's see if machine learning or AI can contribute to the solution of that problem. Now, if those two answers are yes, now we have this pipeline that means that your specialist spends all their time gaining the domain knowledge and matching it with their knowledge of machine learning models and AI to get your outcome. And they're not worried about ETL and data sanitation and all that other stuff and classifying and all that other stuff. But that's what we had to get to make it, I think, far more accessible than before.
Okay, so 2023, you're the chief technologist of AWS Australia. What does that entail?
it's a question I get asked by lots of people, both internally and externally. Really, really, the way I'd articulate it is I'm responsible for helping people understand the vision that AWS has and Amazon has for how we can develop and build technology. But more importantly, I'm that liaison for the senior technologists in our customer organizations giving feedback and having important dialogue. And sometimes that's them telling me, hey, Amazon should go build this. That'd be really helpful, or this should be better, or we really like this thing. Please keep doing it. But also it can be how do I organize my organization to take advantage of this? Or can you come and speak with me to the CEO or the board and explain what this future looks like? Because it's really difficult for people who aren't in the industry or don't have the technical knowledge to grasp what you can do with it. And this struck home for me just last week. I was presenting at an event, and it was for the medical profession. And so we had a room full of highly skilled doctors and radiologists and all these folks. And as part of the sessions, there were a lot of very deep dive sessions into their industry and their domain. And I'm sitting there going, I'm so dumb. I don't understand anything they're talking about. This is really quite intimidating. And then I sat back and thought, that's how they feel when we talk about technology. It's exactly the same experience. And so a lot of the role of the chief technologist is the translator, is being able to translate between the cool technology stuff and the businessy stuff and the industry stuff and kind of bring it all together with a bit of looking around corners and trying to understand what's coming as well. And it's one of these, you know, really sort of not, you know, ill-defined spaces. There's a huge amount of ambiguity, a huge amount of uncertainty, and you've got to sort of revel in that. And for me, the grounding for me in this, all of that, is diving super deep with the technology and staying really connected to the technology. And I think that's vital to both maintain a degree of relevance, but also integrity in what you're talking about and how, and understanding how things work and actually trying things and go, well, I built this and this really sucked, or this worked really well, or wow, I didn't imagine this would be like this. And you know, one of the things I keep running across for particularly senior technology folks is we're kind of forced into this decision of, if you want to become quote unquote more senior, and you can argue whether being a manager or a director is more senior, but I'll just put quotes around that, that you have to kind of make this choice to move away from the technology, and you have to be a manager. And you know, I often say if you're using spreadsheets and PowerPoint as your primary operating system, you've kind of lost your way. And it's really important for technologists to stay close to the technology, to be able to actually bring value to what they're talking about and bring credibility to what they're talking about. And it's interesting to me, I think the organizations that are increasingly competitive are the ones that have not just that digital literacy in their leadership team, but that actual experiential relevance. Not that they've read it in a magazine while flying between cities, but they actually know what they talk about. And you could figure that out in a few simple questions, and it dictates the future. So that's a very long-winded way of saying I do a whole bunch of random stuff that could be presenting in front of lots of people. It could be, you know, I host the AWS podcast, so there's that, down to going in and sitting with a customer one-to-one and hitting the whiteboard and solving all their problems, or a big swathe of them with the magic of a whiteboard marker and a big whiteboard.
Man, I'm not going to lie, I'm actually kind of jealous.
No, it took me 30 years to get here, so, you know. Yeah.
So, but to that one point you mentioned before, I know what you mean. Actually, getting the hands-on practical experience to stay in line with the technology, in step with the technology, super valuable. You can always sort of tell someone when you ask them some questions, just one or two, three questions, like probe a little bit. Yep. You know, their understanding quickly breaks down. So you have to get that hands-on experience. So again, what do you see? We'll get to the large language model stuff in a little bit. Yeah. But outside of that, what other cloud trends are you seeing, I guess, in the last 2-3 years? Where are we up to now?
I think for me, I think the biggest area has been that of sort of event-driven architectures. I think that's become really something that has changed the way people build software. And this ties into sort of serverless and asynchronousness and all those the nessnesses. But again, it's kind of an expression again of that fundamental desire. Like when I started in IT, people were already talking about, we just want to write the code that encapsulates our business logic. We don't want to do anything else. Yet we'd start with, okay, now let's figure out what CPU you're going to use and how much memory you need in your boxes and your network, da, da, da. It was just, and so on and so forth. The ability today to say, I'm just going to write 100 lines of Python, I'm going to throw it into a Lambda function, and I can call it a billion times, is unbelievably fantastic. And the fact that it provides a even more secure platform, it provides a more maintainable platform, it provides a cheaper platform, is just a boon. And so it's not for every single use case. You know, again, I hasten to add that architecture is all about using the right tool for the right job, but it's about opening your mind to all the tools that you have available. And I see a lot of folks, I can almost date when people have gone on their last training course by some of the solutions they architect.
Yeah.
Because they'll build something and I go, oh yeah, you must have gone on the VMware course that was back in 2016. Mm. And so that's your frame of reference. And so that's how you're building everything. But unfortunately for you, it's 2023 and a few things have changed, and that, which is the challenge of IT. And so for me, it's this ability to move super quickly and build systems very fast that scale hugely and then can be switched off. And, you know, it's often joked, unfortunately, that COVID was the biggest digital disruptor of any organization, well beyond the CDO and other roles that should have been doing it. But it was. The reality is it showed what could be done. And almost without exception, all the things that were built to service populations and large scale were built on the cloud and in general were built serverlessly. And as a taxpayer, I love that because it means it was A, super secure, B, it just worked, and C, when COVID finished in the different jurisdictions, they turned it off and people stopped paying for it. It's never happened before at that level. Like that's a big change. And I think we underestimate the impact of that on the way government and companies can build software. Similarly, now we're coming to some pretty significant headwinds when it comes to the economy, and a lot of organizations are trying to economize, and we love that. You know, we want our customers to spend less. So if people need to turn stuff off, they can. You know, we have airline customers who throughout COVID weren't flying. In the old days, they'd be running their systems, just chewing power, belching carbon. But on the cloud, they just turned them all off. It was fantastic. That's how it should be. And I think these types of things are becoming really important. And just as an adjunct to that, I think this real focus on sustainability and how much processing costs from an ecological standpoint is another really important juncture that we're at. And I think it's apparent that it's the right thing to do and regulation is coming. So those two things are sort of coming together. And so customers are saying, hey, how do I build something more sustainable? How do I make sure my power is coming from a wind farm or from a solar farm? You know, how am I operating in a carbon neutral way, et cetera? And, you know, we've been working very hard towards all of those goals to make sure that our customers can deploy on us in a sustainable way. And I think that's another really interesting twist on what's going on. That it's even harder to build your own data center now because now you've got to think about all those things. And it was already hard to do in the first place.
Yeah. So we have sustainability. I definitely agree. It's good that I actually think it's good that regulation's coming. And event-driven architectures for sure is massive. Is there any others that you can think of?
There are lots. I guess I was calling out my favorite, which is event-driven architecture. Clearly, the move to data mesh is, I think, a really important one in terms of recognizing that we've taken a big step in terms of creating data warehouses and data lakes and other formats, but that the matching of producer and consumer in an organized way is really important. And I can't claim this, but someone else said it. I think it was really, really true, which is, everyone wants to buy the data sets or consume the data sets. No one wants to produce the data sets because it's really hard. Mm. And so, you know, you create an unbalanced market of information within an organization. And I think the approach to data mesh is really helping fix that problem by making it very easy to provide your data to others and have them use it without having a heavy load.
And do you and mind? I'm not familiar with what data mesh is.
Oh, so data mesh in a nutshell is really abstracting the producer and the consumer in a way that as a data steward or producer, I can present my data in a controlled fashion to others, but I don't have to manage the process of them accessing it or obtaining access to it. And as a consumer, I don't have to worry about the implementation details on your side around how you built your data and data accessibility, but I can pull data from it in an approved and appropriate way and
use
it for the means that I need to. And this is kind of the next iteration of the original view, which is if you're thinking about the data lake was all that, well, let's just chuck all the data in the one place and we'll call it good. It didn't work out that way because it wasn't good. It was difficult. It's too big. It's too unwieldy. Then you've got issues of control. Not to mention the fact that maintaining the data sets, whose responsibility does that become, et cetera. This is more a distributed model. I like distributed models of data management with that centralized governance and control, but without the impedance that often comes with that.
I did not know about that. So just learned something. Awesome. Okay, so this suite of technologies, okay, let's sort of dive a little bit into the machine learning AI side of things. Yeah. It's, as you know, moving ridiculously fast. what are some resources that you would recommend to others to stay up to date? What do you use?
It is moving fast, and it's interesting. I've taken with this particular domain a very multimedia approach to it, if I can put it that way. There are some really great YouTube videos from practitioners talking about the deep dive there, and I really like those. I like seeing people build and discuss how they build things and really bring it to life. I think that's super valuable, particularly in this domain. You know, I'll tell you right now, I'm hopeless at math. Maths is not my strong suit, which is pretty funny because I work in IT, but hey, there you go. But you know, the maths that's involved in these large language models, et cetera, is so far beyond my comprehension. I can't lean on that to know that. So I'm leaning on you know, the shoulders of giants who have great maths brains to tell me, how does this work? How's this tokenization working? What does it mean when we go from 4K to 16K to 32K? Help me understand all these things. So I'm using that. A lot of reading. I love to read. You know, things like Hacker News and these types of technology places, I think, are really useful to get that. And it's funny, I often say I read Hacker News for the comments. There's some comments, but I love the debate, and I love, you know, someone will posit an idea, and then someone else who has standing will actually come in and say, well, actually, this is how, and that's where you, because one of the biggest things I've recognized, if I can share that from a learning perspective, is you can't just read things you agree with. You have to read things you disagree with. Because you could be wrong. You know, we have this, you know, one of the leadership principles we have at Amazon is are right a lot. And part of that is not being right all the time and recognizing that sometimes you've got to disconfirm your own beliefs. You've got to figure out, you know, is everything I think wrong? And it can be. And if you have enough humility to do that, you end up being better over time because you learn what you don't know. And so I think with this type of advance, it's really easy to get caught up in the froth and the hype. And as I mentioned, I've been around long enough to have lived through many of these. You know, I lived through the dot-com boom, yet wasn't smart enough to cash out on that one. So that says something. but you know, that was the sort of the biggest of all examples. This, what we're seeing now, is nothing compared to what that was like. That was, you know, there's a new economy. All the old rules don't apply, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Narrator comes in and says that was not true. You know, this one I think is really interesting in that there is a huge new capability made available. And how and where we use it becomes the decision that's important to make. It's the technology is certainly not perfect. You know, it's interesting. I did a fun experiment. I asked one of the large language models to tell me where I had worked. And it gave me an incredibly credible answer that was 80% wrong. So it told me my whole career, a lot of companies I'd never worked at, a lot of roles I never held, but it read really well. But where I see at the moment, from my viewpoint, it adding a huge amount of value is purely in software development. The ability to build code and to get rid of a lot of the boilerplate, the error checking, et cetera, is unbelievably good. I mean, I use, you know, at Amazon we have something called Code Whisperer, which uses large language model to do that in your development. And it probably makes me five times faster than I would be. Now, that's because when it deploys code, I know what to look for as well. You know, I'm also seeing, well, is this actually solving my problem? Spoiler alert, it writes way better error checking than I've ever written in my life. But I think if you have a certain level of experience, it can really help. And I think the augmentation of human activity is where this domain is going to be really interesting. The challenge is, of course, it has the focus of mainstream, and that can be a good thing or a bad thing. Because without hesitation, I'll say that we will go through the peak of expectations and the trough of disillusionment and all those Gartner stages that are absolutely true. They happen every time with technology. And so we're probably at the peak at the moment, and then people will get frustrated, and then we'll use it for really useful things.
Yeah. Let's dive into this a little bit. Doing some research prior to this podcast, I know that Amazon released something called, I think it's AWS Bedrock.
Bedrock. Yep.
And it's partnership with Hugging Face, I think.
A number of different providers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A number of different providers and also our own models as well, because the way we're approaching this sort of space is we think that it's going to be really interesting to see what people come up with, and we want people to experiment and to deploy and to test and to iterate. And so we want a whole bunch of leading foundation models available for customers to use. and then they can build upon those models. But as they're building upon those models, they maintain control of their data and the models that they create from those as well. So it's very much about that stewardship of your own information and making sure that security is number one in what you're doing, but taking advantage of what is a very fast-moving environment. And I think it's this classic case of when people say, well, what can you do with it? Then the answer is, well, what can you do with it? You know, we'll figure it out. And folks are going to figure out things that are better and things that aren't so good. And it's too early to call. So having a place that you can do this, again, at low cost, low risk, is really important because, you know, it's moving so quickly. How do you know what to build and how to do it? And the reason why it moves so quickly is because there is this access to vast amounts of storage and vast amounts of compute to build these foundation models. It's fascinating. I mean, for you, it must be like all your Christmases have come at once. Like it's just everything's going bananas. It's almost overwhelming.
It's ridiculous at the moment. Yeah. How are you, when you're speaking to customers, how are you helping them navigate this technology? Are you helping them onboard it? Are you saying, like you mentioned before, you know, it may not be a tool for every job. You know, use X instead of Y in terms of large language models, though, to be specific.
You know, they say that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And so this is very much like the, what can I use machine learning for? Well, what's your business problem? This is similar but different in that we have to go through the phase and the exploration of what can it do reliably and meaningfully. And then what does that mean for business processes and which business processes will change and which ones won't change? And I think at the moment it's a very big, we just don't know. We know things were going to change. And it's interesting as these models iterate and improve, some of them do some really cool things. Like there was an example, there's something I use myself just recently is a service that uses ChatGPT to filter the news for you. Because the hypothesis this person had was that newspapers have to fill space, be it virtual or physical space. And funnily enough, there's the same amount of news every day, but surely it's not the same level of importance every day. And so what he did is built a model where he submits 1,000 of the top news stories every day to the model. The model scores it based on a variety of factors, including relevance and reach and importance, et cetera. Mm. And you know, the score can be between 0 and 10, and only articles above the score of 6 get shown to you on a daily basis. And so some days you'll get 5 articles, some days you get 1 article, and it's fantastic. And it's a really interesting use of the technology to say, well, this is a filter. Now, it's not creating anything, but it's actually, I'm using this as a filter to save myself a whole lot of other stuff to free my brain up. And so it's these types of use cases that I find really appealing because I think this helps make our life better and lets us turn our minds to far more creative pursuits rather than trying to figure out, well, do I now read everything on my plate and then filter it down? And to your point earlier on, you know, it's hard to keep up with the world, let alone news and then technology and then other things. Having a tool like this makes it trivial to do. So a very clever idea. I thought it was really impressive. I think it's News Minimalist or something like that is the site. But it just struck me as a very intelligent use of the technology in a way that can improve quality of life.
Yeah. To go back to one of your points you just mentioned, I feel that like there's a lot of stuff happening in parallel here, like exploration of what the technology is capable of and the use cases at the same time. And like it's sort of converging to find who the early adopters will be as well, to go through that whole cycle of early adopter, early adopters and so on. Yeah. To sort of go on with that sort of angle, what are some advantages or use cases that you've seen? I don't know how much you could talk about, but some of the ones that you can perhaps. So you mentioned news filtering. Is there anything else that you've seen that's been super interesting?
Yeah. So I think, like I said, it's too early to say, yes, it should be used for this or no, it shouldn't be used for that. I think where I'm seeing a lot of experimentation is in customer interaction, is in text summarization is a really big one. Obviously, image generation is huge. That's a really interesting area and really disruptive. Personalization as well is really going to change through this technology. And I think we're only at the very, very, very beginning of all that. And of course, this is also, in a sense, the reimagining of the search experience. Yeah, it's almost like what we wanted to have from Star Trek of ask the computer a question, get an answer based upon the corpus of everything. But it's a challenge because, like I said, it's very early days, and even the biggest models are working on outdated information as well. You know, they're using information up to, for argument's sake, 2021. Well, a couple of, a year and a half has happened since then. Stuff changes. So, from my perspective, it's too early to call. We know there's something happening and we know it's important, but we need to understand what's going on. I think what's different is the speed of which it's happening. And I don't think this is necessarily because it's AI. I think it's just technology these days. Like, and as I say, I've been around and every iteration happens, it just happens faster and faster and faster and faster. So this compression of time is a challenge as a practitioner.
As a technologist.
And particularly if it's in your own domain where you're supposed to be the expert on everything all the time. But one particular branch has really grown, and I know there's a lot of angst for a lot of folks in academia going, well, has all my research been for nothing? Well, the answer is no. But no. It's hard when you see some of the other stuff sort of flying off in the distance. You're like, wow, what just happened here?
Just to ask you one question, and this will be pushing my luck, but is there any so what AWS did for SageMaker, is there any sort of is Bedrock going to be that for LLMs in the future?
I think Bedrock is the place to watch that innovation take place to help customers move quickly and securely and to have control over the data as these models take place. One of the great things is we get to iterate on that particular service with both the producers of the models and also the consumers of the models. So bringing those two viewpoints together, I think, will get us to a really good place very, very quickly. In a way, again, that for folks who aren't sure, they can try, they can test, they can experiment, no risk, very low cost.
Yeah, because I think choosing the right partners, like Hugging Face, definitely. I think Anthropic might be one. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Yep. A21 Labs, Anthropic, Stability AI, Amazon, Hugging Face.
Yes, Stability, they behind Stable Diffusion. Because there's been a lot of media news around safety for these things as well. They can like you said just before, have the ability to hallucinate 80% of your career history, for example. So having the right partners to get them on the right right track. Definitely a plus. So just I think to wrap it up, where do you think, in your take, Simon, where do you think this is all going? LLMs and this branch of machine learning. Yeah.
Look, I don't think it's a forever thing, in as much as we just keep making bigger and bigger ones that keep on going. Because they get horrendously expensive to build and to run, also from an ecological standpoint, consume a lot of power too. So it becomes a sort of finite point. I think in true human fashion, we will experiment with a bunch of things and we'll figure out where it fits very neatly, and that'll just become normal. And then we'll move on to the next innovation and the next thing. Now, that may, again, be underpinned by the fact that you have this technology available. So you look at this technology and say, well, you couldn't have done this if you didn't have cloud computing. And you couldn't do cloud computing if you didn't have, great advances in the way we build chipsets and supply hardware. And everything's turtles all the way down, as they say. So I think what we're likely to see here is this really interesting phase of experimentation and exploration and debate about where it fits, how it fits, how it should be used. And that has to be done in a sensible fashion. And then we'll see what the ground truth looks like and make decisions based upon the best current information. I think it's very difficult to tell the future. 100%. If any of us could predict the future with great accuracy, we wouldn't be talking on a podcast.
No, I'd be buying an island.
Being on a beach.
Yeah, that's it for sure. Simon, absolutely fascinating to talk with you today. And to see where this whole field is potentially going. I agree with you that I think it's we're definitely in the exploration phase, but it's already the grounds are sort of being laid with potential infrastructure for the future. Any last words for the listeners?
Look, I think as with all these things, I'll come back to some fundamental advice, which is to be stubborn on the vision, but flexible on the detail. And really what that means is that the end goal you're trying to get to is something you're going to maintain pretty fixed, but the way you get there is going to change. And keeping an open mind with new technologies like this is a healthy way to be. And keeping an open mind doesn't mean you always change your mind, but it just means you're open to new ideas and you get the best of all world.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Stay curious.
Spot on.
Yeah, yeah. Spot on. Simon, absolute pleasure. Cheers, man.
Thanks so much.